Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, discover the essential writings of the late scholar Martin Lings, curated by Dr. Reza Shah Kazemi. This collection brings together some of the most remarkable chapters from Lings' extensive body of work, including his insights into the perennial philosophy and writings on Islam and Sufism. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, Shah Kazemi guides you through selected passages from the book, focusing particularly on the mystical depths found from within Hamlet.
Thanks very much, and thank you all for coming to this. This is the first launch of the book that I edited, The Essential Martin Lings. It came out just the end of last year. A little bit of an introduction about myself and why I edited this book. My name's Reza Shah Kazemi, and I'm a research associate at the Institute of Ismaili Studies. I've written books in the fields of comparative religion, Sufism, Quranic studies, and I happen to have been the neighbour of this very great man, Martin Lings. His Muslim name was Sheikh Abu Bakr Siraj ad-Din, and he died in 2005. I lived next door to him in French Street, Westram, Kent, from 1989 to 2005. So I had the privilege of seeing at first hand this extraordinary saintly man who was known by all who had the privilege of coming into his blessed proximity as a saint, as a waliullah in Islamic terms. But the great Schumacher went to visit him at the British Museum when he was keeper of the Oriental manuscripts there. And he came out and went to Keith Critchlow at the then Prince's School of Traditional Arts and said that, do you know you have a saint in the British Museum? So it wasn't just Muslims who recognized a living saint. It was also Westerners, Christians, who did that. So what I'm going to do is begin with something from his own self-portrait. Dr. Lings was known as a perennialist, as following the school of perennial philosophy. And this philosophy implies that God has sent revelations to all of humanity from the first revelation to Adam after the fall, right up until the last revelation, that of the religion of Islam. And perennialists are sometimes accused of being sentimentalists and that they hark back to a golden age where religion was still vibrant and strong in all parts of the world, different religions. And there's no real truth to that allegation. But in his self-portrait, Dr. Lings goes through the different, this is a poem he wrote, he goes through the different revelations. And he says rather wistfully, oh, if only I had been there when Mary and Jesus exchanged looks. If only I had been there to give my hand in fealty to the Arabian prophet. If only I had been there when Orpheus was playing his flute. If only I had been... This is not his poem, of course. This is me just summarizing it. But you would think as you read this poem that, oh, he is being rather sentimental, that he wishes he had been there. But then in the very last verse, the last 10 lines or so, he says the following: such blessings missed, time was when I within myself would wonder why, half quarreling with the book of fate for having writ me down so late. But now I no longer my lot can question, and of what was not. No more I say, would it had been, for I have seen what I have seen, and I have heard what I have heard. So if to tears you see me stirred, presume not that they spring from woe. In thankful wonderment they flow. Praise be to him, the Lord, the King, who gives beyond all reckoning. So there he's saying that he's no longer ruining the fact that he wasn't there at the time of the great revelations. He's saying, I have seen what I have seen. And what one has here is the vision, the audition of a man who has seen the quintessence of the revelations, who has heard the quintessence of all of the revelations. Because this was a man who had understood that when God speaks, when God reveals himself, herself, itself, whatever be the language, whatever be the form, whether it be the word made flesh, whether it be the word made book, and this was a man who had penetrated to the essence of those revelations and could therefore assimilate all of those revelations while pursuing one in particular. This is an extremely important part of Dr. Lings's practical application of the perennial philosophy, which is that you only follow one path. You don't have a syncretistic approach and bring elements from this path or that, bringing them together and thinking that you can come closer to God through your own fabrication, your own construction. You follow the path of one revelation. Now, what I'm going to do is to focus rather than try and give you a summary of the many features that have been covered in this book, from hermeneutics and traditional art, traditional psychology, Quranic calligraphy, the perennial philosophy. I want to really go into some depth as regards Hamlet, his reflections upon Hamlet, because one of the most important penetrating appraisals that Dr. Lings has given on the basis of esotericism, of the inner dimension of religions, is his revelation of the deeper mystical meanings of Shakespeare's plays. And rather than give a sort of overview of different plays, I want to go into some depth in terms of Hamlet. Before I do so, I'll just mention one of the images that Dr. Lings gives us in his book, What is Sufism, in regard to the paradox that the closer you come to the essence, to the center, to the summit of your own particular religious path, the closer you come to the mysticisms, the esoteric paths of all of the other religions. Now, the image that's given in the perennial philosophy is a well-known one of a circumference with a center, and then radii going from the circumference to the center. The radius represents the inner dimension of the religion, and the circumference is the starting point on the outer aspect of the religion. So in Islamic terms, the circumference would be the Sharia, and the radius would be the Tariqah, and the center would be the haqiqah. And so the path consists of going from the practice of the sharia to the following of the tariqah to the attainment of the haqiqah. And this applies to all of the religions. They all have an outer aspect, an inner aspect, and then a mystical core where the divine itself resides. And so Dr. Lings says that one obvious aspect of this image is that as you're following your particular mystical path towards the center, you come closer to the mystical paths of all of the other religions. Obviously, the distance between the radii gets less and less and less, until at the center, there is no difference between any of the radii. You're all one at the center. But then he adds this point, which is extremely important in helping us to understand how it was that he could combine this universalist, perennial view of the religious phenomenon with a deep appreciation of all of the beauty, the sacred art, the sanctity, the traditional civilizations attached to those revelations, and at the same time be able to penetrate with so much depth and clarity into what the Islamic essence produced in the way of his writings on calligraphy and Sufism, his famous book on the Prophet Muhammad, and his book on the saint Sheikh Al-Alawi, one of the greatest biographies of a Sufi saint, and certainly the greatest biography on the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So what Dr. Lings does in this image, he helps us to understand that as you're approaching the center of your particular religion, which is also the center of all of the religions, as you're approaching, you're not only coming closer to the mystical essence, you're also receiving something from that mystical essence. And what he calls that something is a more concentrated dose of the pulsation, the emanation, the gift that's being given to you constantly from the living heart of your faith. So at one and the same time, you're coming closer to what makes the essence of all true religion, and you're receiving from God, from that center, that living, pulsating heart, the lifeblood, the idée force, that forceful, concentrated essence that's coming to you. And it's coming to all of us all the time from our respective revelations, whatever may be the path that we're following. It's coming to us, but we're not receptive to it because we're not ourselves making enough of an effort to open ourselves up to that radiance, that emanation that's coming from God to us through the form of our revelation. So that's an image that I think helps us to understand how he could penetrate into Islam with so much depth at the same time as being able to comment so revealingly, insightfully on subjects as diverse as Shakespeare and of traditional symbolism of art, calligraphy, and so on. So I'm going to start with the presentation now, and I've called it Spiritual Warfare, Reflections on Hamlet in the Light of the Writings of Martin Lings. First of all, I just want to refer to this quite remarkable statement by a living philosopher, Said Hussein Nasr, who is extremely well known in the world. He's written many, many books, many subjects, mostly on the Islamic tradition. And he goes so far as to say that Shakespeare is the poet of the age today because he is the greatest master of the English language. And English is spreading all over the world. Now is the time to revive Shakespeare seriously. So he's implying here that Shakespeare is an artist capable of conveying a living spiritual message in the English language and being a master dramatist, psychologist, and, according to Dr. Lings, a master esoterist, a master of the spiritual path. Because the main point that Dr. Lings makes in his book on Shakespeare, and we've got in this Essential Writings one chapter from that, well, two chapters, one on Hamlet and one called The Secret of Shakespeare, which is a remarkable essay, The Secret of Shakespeare, something we may come to in the Q&A, and I think we'll have at least 15 or 20 minutes for questions and answers at the end of this. So the present King Charles III, when he was still the Prince of Wales, he wrote the preface to the book on Shakespeare, the book of Dr. Lings on Shakespeare, and said there that it's this book that's helped him to understand the deeper spiritual meaning of the plays. And what is this deeper spiritual meaning? The deeper meaning is that Shakespeare, according to Dr. Lings, is conveying through drama, through a narrative, through a dramaturgy, a way of making the energy of drama speak to the deepest realities of the human soul in its quest for purification and ultimately perfection. Purification that is a preparation for entering into the true life in paradise in the hereafter, but also a purgatorial purification of one's sinfulness in this life. And that's the spiritual path. So as he says here, Hamlet and original sin. The basic theme of Hamlet is summed up in the prince's own words.
Virtue cannot so inoculate our old stock, but we shall relish of it. This means, Dr. Lings explains, it's no use plastering one or two superficial virtues over our old stock, that is, the original sin which permeates our nature, since in spite of all such virtues, we shall continue to reek of the old stock. The old stock is an image in gardening terms of an old plant that you yourself constitute. You're getting rid of it, you're implanting a new scion onto your old stock. And this is, according to Dr. Lings, the basic meaning of Hamlet, why it is that revenge has to be absolute. You're taking revenge upon your own sinful propensities, and that each and every one of us in this world, we, what in Christian terms is referred to as the original sin, the sin of Adam, all of us come into this world as fallen beings. We have participated in some way in the fall of Adam, and the only way we can redeem ourselves is by following the revelations that have come to help us to rise back up to the Edenic primordial state. So, initiation and the greatest jihad. This greatest jihad is what the Prophet referred to when he came back from a battle after the fall of Mecca. It was the Battle of Hunain, and he came back from this battle, and he said, we have returned from the lesser battle, al-jihad, al-asghar, to fight the greater battle, the greater jihad, al-jihad al-akbar. And they said, what is greater than this? And he said, the war against your own soul, jihad and nafs, the battle that is permanent, is absolute, and is inward, as opposed to the occasional outward battles in the outer world that you're forced to do in self-defense. This battle is permanent, not from time to time. It's absolute, it's not relative, it's not something mild, it's something you have to put your heart and soul into at every moment of the existence that you have when you're aware of what you're doing that is wrong and is manifesting a spiritual fault, a moral shortcoming, a psychological disorder. All of these are manifestations of your fallen state, and you have to fight against all of them if you are to be true to what the Prophet called the greatest holy struggle, against your own ego. So, Dr. Ling says, initiation into a spiritual path, the taking of what in Islam is called bay'ah, but in other traditions it has different names. The Christian tradition, you go to a staret, the Eastern Orthodox tradition, and you make a vow to give yourself to God with all your heart and soul, and to follow the spiritual direction given to you by your master, and to follow the spiritual path of primarily the invocation of the name of Jesus, the Jesus prayer. In Christianity, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy upon me, a sinner. In the Islamic framework, it's the dhikrullah, the remembrance of God, the focus on one name of the divine. Most often, either the shahada, la ilaha illallah, or the name Allah. So this is initiation. You put your hand into the hand of your master, and you make a total commitment to give yourself to God for the rest of your life. So Dr. Ling says, initiation, followed up by the devotional and ascetic practices that are implicit in it, opens the door to contact with the perfecting and unifying power of the spirit. The spirit whose presence demands that the psychic substance shall become once again a single whole. The more or less scattered elements of this substance are thus compelled to come together, and some of them come in anger from dark and remote hiding places, with the infernal powers still attached to them. That's a very powerful phrase. The infernal powers, the hellish powers, the satanic energies still attached to these scattered elements of our souls that we're unaware of at the beginning of our spiritual lives, as we'll come to in a moment when Hamlet talks about him being indifferent, honest. Well, we may not come to that actually, but I'll say it now. Some of you may know this very famous speech of Hamlet when He's decided that he's got to pretend to be mad. He's got to take revenge upon his... Do all of you know the basic plot of Hamlet? Oh, good. So I don't need to talk about him seeing his father's ghost and so on. He's now decided he's got to take revenge on his uncle. He's seen his father's ghost. He knows what's happened. He now tells Ophelia, the one to whom he's betrothed, that she should go to a convent. Get thee to a nunnery, he says. Don't have anything to do with us. We're all arrant knaves. And then he makes a little comment about himself that is very, very revealing. And it's this talk of the dark, remote hiding places, the infernal power still attached to these scattered elements of the psychic substance. We're a chaos when we begin the spiritual life. We're scattered in all different places. And all of these things have to come from these hiding places. And Dr. Ling says they come with infernal powers attached to them. So what does Hamlet do to reveal this? He says to Ophelia, I am myself indifferent, honest, and yet I could accuse me of such things as would make my mother wish she never born me. I am very proud. I am vengeful. I am ambitious. So he goes through this list, and then he says something extraordinary, that I have more offenses at my beck, meaning I have more things I want to do that are wrong than I have thoughts to give them form or time to act them in. So he's now come into contact with the level of his subconscious psyche, what Jung would call the shadow, the evil propensities that we all think that we don't really have. We are all saying, I am indifferent, honest. I'm not good, I'm not bad, I'm an honest person, I'm straightforward about my minor flaws, but I'm basically a good human being. That's what most of us think. So that's what Hamlet says. But then he adds, I have got these evil propensities. I have more offenses. I have more things that I want to do that are wrong than I have even thoughts to give them form. So this is what happens at the beginning of the spiritual path, according to Dr. Ling's, initiation followed up by the devotional and ascetic practices that are implicit in it opens the door to contact with the perfecting and unifying power of the spirit. The spirit is suddenly made present in your soul. And that is a perfecting and a unifying power. And the jihad begins. From this point of view, Dr. Ling says, it's truer to say that hell rises than that the mystic descends. And the result of this rising is a battle between the mighty opposites. That's a phrase from Hamlet. Mighty opposites is when Hamlet is speaking to Horatio and refers to himself and Claudius, his uncle, as being the mighty opposites, implying that he is fighting on the side of heaven, his uncle on the side of hell. Those are the mighty opposites, and this is the battle. Initiation into the mysteries is nothing other than the inoculating or grafting of a scion of man's primordial nature onto the old stock of his fallen nature. It's like a plant from our true, pure selves being supplanted, being implanted onto our old stock. The fallen nature thus will be effaced, stench and all. Remember, Hamlet said, it will still reek of the old stock. I will still be this impure, fallen being, even if I try and plaster at one or two superficial virtues over it. Provided that the new primordial scion be duly tended and implacably protected against any suckers that the old stock may put forth in an attempt to re-establish itself. And what he means here is that the beginning of the spiritual path, you make your initiation, you're full of enthusiasm, you feel as if you've received this grace from the chain of spiritual masters that links you to the origin of your revelation, and then you find that your old self is reasserting itself. And you have to ensure that you redouble your efforts, your prayers, and your spiritual struggle. The tending and protection, that protection, are the rites and the disciplines of the lesser mysteries, the path of purification from original sin, and the recovery thereby of man's Edenic state. To recover the state of Eden, that's the path of the lesser mysteries. What are the greater mysteries? those which happen after death, whether it be physical death and entering into paradise and into the modes of union with the divine, or spiritual death in this world, which in Sufism is called fana, annihilation, extinction. And that spiritual death implies those modalities of union with God that are ineffable, that can hardly be spoken about. What the great Sufi mystic Al-Halaj blurted out by saying, Ana al-Haq, I am the real, I am the true. In other words, asserting a mode of union with God. Those are the greater mysteries. Normally about those one doesn't speak. And certainly Halaj didn't reveal anything that could be used as a means of approach to those greater mysteries. He was just talking about the fruit of the realization of the greater mystery. Now to the Jihad al-Akbar. This path of purification is precisely what the Prophet called the Greater Holy War. In What is Sufism, Lings explains that only the mystic knows what it is to keep up a methodic opposition to his own lower possibilities and to carry the war into the enemy's territory so that the whole soul may be for God. By contrast, the path of exoterism, attachment to the externals of religion, is a state of truce with occasional desultory skirmishes. So every Muslim, according to Dr. Lings, is at war with the adversary. But the difference between the ordinary Muslim and the Sufi, the mystic, the one who has been initiated, is that the mystic takes the war into the enemy's territory. It's as if you've got these trenches. The mystic is the one who comes out of the trench and actually goes into the enemy territory and takes on the enemy in his own territory. Whereas the ordinary Muslim is one who will stay in the trench, have a truce most of the time with the enemy, and occasionally lob over some kind of bomb or something that says, yes, I'm actually at war with you. But it's desultory skirmishes. It's not a true all-out war against the enemy within. It's a kind of uneasy truce. So return to Hamlet's sentence, virtue cannot so inoculate our old stock, but we shall relish of it. It's no use just trying to plaster one or two virtues over our fallen state. We need a complete reversal of the fall. In order to express fully what is in Hamlet's mind here, we must add, there is only one thing which can effectively wipe out the stench of our old stock, and that is the complete reversal of the fall, total liberation from the grip of the enemy of mankind. In other words, the slaying of the dragon, or more simply, in the language of the play, revenge. And I put there the divine name Al-Muntaqim. That's the name of God, which means the avenger. Not reward, but revenge. Now, this is one of the most dramatic parts of the play, an episode where Hamlet, he's put on the play where the uncle has seen exactly what he's done to his brother. And he now is full of guilt and he's rushing off to pray and to try and make amends. And Hamlet sees him praying in a state of great repentance, remorse, weeping and trying to pray to God to forgive him. And Hamlet says, right, now is the time I can kill him. But why does he not kill him? This is what Hamlet says. Now might I do it, Pat, meaning easily. Now might I do it, Pat. Now he is praying, and now I'll do it. And so he goes to heaven. And so am I revenged. That would be scanned. This is where the actor has to be very careful. I haven't really seen him do it very well, whether it's Mel Gibson or Derek Jacobi or whoever. That should be said very, very slowly. Dr. Lings, he actually put on various plays of Shakespeare when he was teaching English literature at Cairo University. And he would have had these words said very, very slowly, because that would be scanned. Means I'd have to think about this. What am I doing? I kill him now. He's praying in repentance, and I send him to heaven. Is that revenge? A villain kills my father, and for that, I, his sole son, do this same villain send to heaven. Oh, this is hire and salary, not revenge. Hire and salary meaning is as if I've hired the man to do this. I'm giving him now his salary that he's killed my father, and now I'm giving him a salary and sending him to heaven because now he's repenting of the act. So he doesn't kill him at this point. And this is because revenge must be absolute. This is where a lot of Christian commentators of Hamlet have taken issue with Shakespeare and said, well, you know, Shakespeare wasn't being very Christian in this play. Look at what he makes Hamlet do. He doesn't allow Hamlet to forgive his uncle when he's in a state of repentance and remorse. Why doesn't he enact the Christian virtue of forgiveness? Why is he insisting on absolute revenge and to kill his uncle? Dr. Lings explains, what sin can compare with the implacable determination to send a soul to hell? How is such appalling malevolence to be reconciled with the fact that Hamlet is unquestionably a man of great nobility and magnanimity of character, with a profound love of good and hatred of evil, and with even much of the priest in his nature? It must be admitted with regard to these questions that the play's deeper meaning strains here the outward sense almost to breaking point. So what he means here is, if we take this play literally and not allegorically or anagogically, these are the three levels at which Dr. Lings is interpreting these plays, and these go back to Dante's Divine Comedy. The literal meaning of the Divine Comedy, the allegorical meaning, and then the anagogical meaning. So applied now to Hamlet, the literal meaning is that this uncle, this evil man, has killed his brother, stolen the crown, stolen his brother's wife. The allegorical meaning is that here the uncle is standing for the serpent in the Garden of Eden, who is responsible for the fall of Adam and Eve. But the anagogical meaning is that the uncle represents the satanic principle within one's own soul, and therefore the revenge has to be absolute. If it was just a question of having revenge on a man who has done something wrong to your father, it would be quite different. But if it's a question of what Shakespeare is doing, outwardly, dramatically symbolizing, personifying the inward aspect of evil within your own self, then you cannot allow mercy or forgiveness to intervene. You have to be resolute in extirpating that element of evil within your soul. And that's why the divine name Al-Muntaqim, the avenger, is so important. You are taking revenge, God's revenge, upon your own evil. So, Dr. Ling says, once the deeper meaning is understood, the difficulties vanish. Revenge on the devil must be absolute. It requires no apology. There must be no scruples and no compromise. There would be no revenge and therefore no self-purification in killing Claudius at that moment, because Claudius is not himself. Sometimes the soul's worst possibilities may manifest themselves only partially in such a way that it would be quite easy to overcome them. So what he means here is that if I have a particular fault of miserliness and I exercise this fault in a small way, it hasn't revealed itself in a major way, I haven't been as avid in holding on to what I've gained with all of the intensity that would reveal this fault for what it is, then for me to simply eliminate this one small act of miserliness, not giving a beggar £2 and just giving him 50 pence, I wouldn't really be coming face to face with the totality of my avidity, of my miserliness, if I were to be faced with a possibility of helping a child. And I have the ability to give the money to that child, to help the child to overcome a major illness, to pay for the operation. And I say, no, I actually want that money to spend it on something else. Then you're becoming much more aware of just how deep your miserliness goes. Mutatis mutandis, taking into account the different levels here. Sometimes the soul's worst possibilities may manifest themselves only partially. Nothing final could be hoped for from resisting them on such an occasion. It's only when those possibilities really show themselves what they are, and then Dr. Lings gives this very strong phrase, when they are rampant in all their iniquity, only then it is possible to kill them. And that's what Hamlet says. When he is drunk, asleep, or in his rage, or in the incestuous pleasure of his bed, at gaming, gambling, swearing, or about some act that has no relish of salvation in it, then trip him, that his heels may kick at heaven, and that his soul may be damned and black as hell, whereto it goes. That's why he doesn't kill Claudius. He's saying, no, if I kill him now, he'll go to heaven. If I kill him when he's enjoying the fruits of his sin, then I send him into hell. So what does this mean spiritually? It means that when I see myself engaging in, even if it's only in my imagination, but engaging in my worst sin, I have to have no mercy against myself. I have to fight against that fault and to eliminate it completely, send it into the hell of non-existence. And that's one of the meanings, one might say, of why it is that hell is depicted as this place of terrible suffering eternally. It's an eternal state of non-existence, of the particular sins that merited hell. First merit the punishment of purification, and then the non-existence. That's the only way in which one's own evil can actually be resolutely dealt with and overcome. So Hamlet's ruthless seeking of absolute revenge becomes immediately understandable and acceptable and reconcilable with his nobility of nature if we realize that all the victims of his revenge are, in a sense, part of himself. So with the help of these keys, Lings opens up for us insights into what is happening in the soul of what he calls every man, the purgatorial pilgrim, the pilgrim who's on the path of purgatory in this life and who is trying to prepare himself or herself for paradise. Prayer is given by Dr. Lings as the key weapon by means of which revenge and redemption are attained. Hamlet says, without more circumstance at all, I hold it fit that we shake hands and part. This is when he's talking to Horatio and the other guards that have seen the ghost. You as your business and your desire shall point you, for every man hath business and desire, such as it is, and for mine own poor part, look you, I'll go pray. Martin Lings comments. Prayer, which in the widest sense of the word may be said to comprise all forms of worship, is in fact man's chief weapon of revenge. And this is where Dr. Lings helps us to shift from a possibly excessive scrupulousness and navel-gazing and unhealthy psychological introspection, which goes too far in seeking out all of one's inner faults. It's a never-ending maze. It's something we can't ourselves resolve. We don't do that. But what Dr. Lings says in many places is, we cannot sort out the chaos of our souls, but God can. And how does God do it? By responding to our prayers. When we pray with earnestness and sincerity, and when we use that strongest of all possible prayers, which is concentrated, one-pointed invocation of the name of God, then that concentration on the divine reality inherent in, contained within, radiating from the name of God, that is what can put right all of the problems of our soul in God's good time. What God asks of us in prayer is absolute trust in God's power to put right what is wrong with us, to help us to save our souls, patience and perseverance in the performance of our prayers. So in practical terms, it amounts to saying that from day to day, the primary concern of the purgatorial pilgrim is how much can I give myself to God in prayer? How much can I... Now we go into one of Dr. Ling's books, What is Sufism?, where he talks about the invocation of the name of God. And he refers to it as, well, in terms of a Quranic verse. In the chapter called Abraham, there is a remarkable passage. And I'll say it to you in the Arabic first and then the translation. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alam tara كيف ضرب الله مثلا كلمة طيبة كشجرة طيبة أصلها ثابت وفرعها في السماء تؤتي أكلها كل حين بإذن ربها ويضرب الله الأمثال للناس لعلهم يتذكرون. Do you not see how God strikes similitudes? A good word is like a good tree. Its roots are firm and its branches reach up into heaven. And it gives its fruits in every season according to the permission of its Lord. And God strikes similitudes for mankind that they might recollect, they might remember, they might invoke. The root of that word is dhikr, yatadhakkarun. So Dr. Ling's comments on this and says that this best of words, the kalimatullah, is the name of God. And that this name of God is firmly rooted in the ground of absolute reality. The branches symbolize the repercussions of the act of prayer, of the act of invoking this word, invoking this name of God, that reach up into heaven. It has reverberations that go all the way up to heaven. And that means going all the way up into the heaven of our own hearts, so that we're rising out of the hell and the purgatory within our soul, and the invocation of the name produces these ramifications, repercussions, reverberations of the word, the verb, going all the way up to heaven. And then the fruits that come forth in every season, not in a particular season, but in all seasons, meaning all the time, the fruits that come from the invocation are the fruits of the virtues of good acts and of their underlying sincere intentions. So these are the three dimensions: the firm root, firm in the dimension of divine reality, the ground of the absolute, the repercussions, the branches that reach up into heaven, how the invocation reaches up to the highest reaches of our own spiritual possibilities, and then the result of the fruits, the virtues that are given all the time. But this, as Dr. Ling says, these three key principles, trust in this sword that's been forged in heaven. So when we're waging this war against the evil within ourselves, it's only a sword that has been forged in heaven that can help us to attain victory. And that sword, the best of those swords, is the name of God. And I'll just finish here with this: polishing the heart, remembering God, calling on the name of God, according to Dr. Ling's, calling on the name of God, invoking the name of God, whether it be accompanied by some experience or not. So it's immaterial whether one experiences anything concrete in the invocation of the name of God. One has to understand that the mere fact of invoking the name of God is its own reward, and it's doing its work at the subtle levels of our soul. And we shouldn't need any kind of palpable psychological or emotional experience. It's not important. It's the principle and not the phenomenon. The principle of invoking the name of God is its own reward, and it should be understood by the intellect and not simply sought after by the imagination. Calling on the name of God, whether it be accompanied by some other experience or not, is the most positive thing in the world, because it sets up the most powerful vibration towards the heart. The Prophet said, "There is a polish for everything that taketh away rust, and the polish of the heart is the invocation of Allah. So this is a reference to a verse in the Quran. It's an allusion, this mention of rust. There's a verse in the Quran that says, "Arrana ala qulubihim ma kanu yaksibun." That which they have done has rusted over their hearts. So this word, kasp, it's the earnings of our bad actions. It's what the Hindus would call karma. It's not what we have done has rusted over our hearts, but what we have earned from our actions has rusted over our hearts. And this is what prevents our hearts from having vision of the divine beauty. So the Prophet is giving us in this saying the key means by which we can remove the rust from the heart, and that is the remembrance of God. So I think I'll stop there, and we have, I think, 15 minutes or so for Q&A. And if anybody has any questions, please don't hesitate to ask. Thank you very much for your attention.
In reference to the original sin, I mean, the concept of the original sin is in Christianity, but in Islam, we understand that, you know, the original sin does not get passed on, and therefore a child is born pure, or every human is born pure. So Dr. Martin Ling's still referring to that original sin, even within the Islamic concept.
Remember that he uses this in his book on Shakespeare. So he's writing that book not for Muslims, he's writing that book for Westerners. So he doesn't explain that what is called original sin in Christianity is called something else in Islam. What is it called in Islam? Dr. Lings would say that even if the doctrine, the theological idea of the transmission of Adam's sin is not found in Islam, what is found is the idea that human beings in this last phase of the cycle of revelation, Islam presents itself as the last revelation. So it's addressing humanity at the end of the cycle. And at the end of the cycle, the Prophet said that every baby that is born is touched at the moment of birth by Satan, and it cries. And then he said, except two, Jesus and his mother. So every single child that's born has the touch of Satan. And the Prophet himself, as you know, had his heart ostensibly taken out of his breast as a child, as an infant, and was washed of a black spot. So this can be taken both literally and metaphorically. Secondly, in the Surah Teen, the Surah of the Fig, it says, لَقَدَ خَلَقَنَا الْإِنسَانَ فِي أَحْسَنِ تَقْوِيمٍ ثُمَّ رَدَدَنَاهُ أَسْفَلَ سَافِلِينَ. We created the human being in the best of statures, the Adamic, Edenic, paradisal, pure state. Then we reduced human beings to the lowest of the low, asfal asafilin. So by definition, we are the lowest of the low, the worst, as it were, of the cycle that we are inhabiting. And then the Surah Al-Asr, which is a very important surah, the late afternoon. Asr means it's the late afternoon before the sun sets. It also is where we get the word for juice, asir. You squeeze something out of the fruit, and that's the juice. So you're squeezing out of the day the last parts of the sunshine. It's the last part. And then you have the idea of the age itself. Asr also means the age. So the age in which we live is the age in which the last rays of sunshine are being squeezed out. And that's the age of humanity. We are at the end of the cycle, very close to the Day of Judgment. And that surah says, well, asr, inna linsana lafi khusr. By the age in which we live, by the age of the setting sun, by the last phase of this cycle, God swears, truly, the human being is in a state of loss. Illa ladhina amanu wa amilu salihati. So accept those who believe and who do good. Those are the ones who are redeeming themselves and bringing themselves out of the state of loss.
In journeying from these from a Muslim that has his daily skirmishes with the evil within to journeying towards sainthood and taking active warfare to the evil within, what are some of the key things that one can do along that journey?
Well, you have to speak to your spiritual master about that. That's the easy answer. And there was a question over there.
Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
Thank you very much for this. In terms of the Jungian shadow work, you talk about the darker aspects of the soul rising and the mystic engages with those. Obviously, you talked about the slaying of the infernal element embodied by the uncle, but actually there's a sense as well that some of the elements themselves, you talked about the need to make the soul whole. So there's a sense of needing to retain, not in the case of the devil, but other elements of the soul that need to be retained, or the infernal elements dispensed with.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I wish we had more time to go into that. I think what Dr. Lings would say, to be as brief as possible, is that the riding the tiger, that's an image that Dr. Lings has used in the past, and it's based on an alchemical principle that these negative energies at their root are not evil. They become evil by virtue of the fall, but that as energies refer to rajasic energy in the Hindu cosmology. Those energies that have been attached to the wrong objects. Now, there's a chapter where Dr. Lings goes into this. Unfortunately, I didn't include it in this volume, but it's the seven deadly sins in the light of symbolism. And he goes through each of the seven deadly sins and regards them as being caricatures or inversions, perversions of fundamentally good intentions. And that the redemption of those good intentions implies, on the one hand, eliminating, getting revenge upon the manifestations in the false domain, but on the other hand, of rechanneling those initial energies. So that, just to give you one quick example, he says that the sin of gluttony, of eating far too much, more than one needs, is a caricature of a legitimate desire for eternity. And that if one can understand that you seek, instead of this appetite which has transcendent dimensions, instead of trying to seek to satisfy the appetite in this world through material means, you satisfy the appetite through reflecting upon the divine promise of absolute, infinite perfection in paradise, which corresponds to the greatest, most infinite aspects of one's own appetite, what one is really looking for. So to redirect the focus of one's attention and allow one's legitimate desires to be satisfied by the divine rather than by the infernal or the terrestrial or the purely human. He would say something like that, I think. So thank you all very much for your attention. I'm sorry we've gone over our time somewhat, but it's been very uplifting to see the receptivity and the attentiveness on all of your faces. Thank you all very much indeed.
Thank you for listening. And thank you to everyone who attended our 2025 Bradford Literature Festival and helped to make it such a success. You'll be able to listen back to some of our selected events in the new series, coming soon.